Hey there, welcome to Backwoods Believe. This is Jeff Wright. I'm here with Ben Woodring, and we're going to talk about institutional bravery. Appreciate you guys hanging with us last week. Ben, you came through in the clutch. I was traveling, and you fed us some meat from the Word. When did you deliver that sermon?
Well, it wasn't a sermon. It was last October at a little Reformation Day service that a church that I was attending at the time had, and the pastor asked me to give a little short Reformation Day talk. And so I decided to, the other guy who was talking did his on justification by faith, and I decided, so they've already heard the justification by faith Reformed message, maybe get into something that you don't as commonly hear on the Reformation and the three offices of Christ and how they apply to us in our family and churches and nation. Just seemed like a really good topic. So.
And that's great. I, you know, as a pastor, I'm pretty envious of the church that gets to have you, you know, just there available to do that stuff. That's nice.
Yeah. So today, speaking of really good lectures that were given, this past week, the reason you weren't able to record is because you were at, was it a homeschooling or no, a Christian schooling conference?
Yeah, it was the Association of Classical and Christian Schools. It's the Doug Wilson started version of classical and Christian education. It was their annual conference.
Okay. And where was that?
It was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. So listen to this, listener. My good friend, Jeff Wright, who I've known for years, though we've never hung out in real life, was in the state where I live and was not able to make the connection work. Now, I will admit that, you know, I only heard about this like a few days before he was going to be there, so it was kind of last minute anyway. But you know, it's just good to know who your friends are.
Okay, that hurts. here's my response. I'm stupid, and I don't know geography. And when you're like, "Hey, I live fairly close to Pittsburgh," I was like, "You know, I guess I should have considered that a possibility." I have the guy who was the best man in my wedding lives, I think, here's how stupid I am. I think he lives on the far side of Pennsylvania from Pittsburgh. He lives in the York Shrewsbury area.
Yeah.
Also, also didn't reach out to him because, man, I don't know where I'm at. I just go where the GPS tells me.
Yeah, it's the north. You don't know.
As soon as I cross the Mason-Dixon line, I'm in hostile enemy territory. And so I do wish we could have made that happen.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You make it up a little bit above Gettysburg, and you're like, "Well, we've never been up here before,
not successfully."
All right. Enough of that before we start fighting. but you gave this lecture there on institutional bravery was the topic, right?
Yeah, that's right. I had given this at a regional event that you know, I don't know who's being polite and whatnot, but it was received. Pretty, you know, it was received warmly. And so I submitted it for a breakout session, and lo and behold, the CCS said, "Yeah, man, go ahead and do this." And again, yeah, so, it was received warmly, but I don't always know how those things are stacked up in terms of who's being polite and what actually was helpful.
Well, I can tell you, having read it, that it's very good, very helpful, and something that I think is necessary for people to hear. And it's not just something that it's going to be helpful if you're, you know, a headmaster of a Christian school. It's going to be helpful for you in your family, in your church, or, you know, in an institution that you're leading. And so that's why I think it'd be really great for us to talk about it. So why don't you go ahead and outline kind of what you mean by institutional bravery and what the implications of it are?
Okay. Well, the genesis of this was me thinking about why institutions moved leftward historically. And I'm involved in a school that I do not want to see move leftward. We are talking about starting a college, a vocational college. If we found it, we want to found it as best we're able in a way that makes it really hard for anyone to move it leftward. I pastor a church that I do not want to see move leftward. I'm trying to raise a family that I don't want to see move leftward. And so I started chewing on what it would mean to hand an institution off. How do you cultivate an institution that's self-consciously right-wing conservative? And then how do you have a plan to hand that off to successive generations in a way that it continues on the right side and it doesn't drift left. And so institutional bravery is the phrase that came to my mind, because I think that is, at least in my reading of history, that's kind of the crux of the matter. It's particularly true in our own day. People are bullied out of conservative positions now because every institution in society basically has capitulated to progressivism, and so they shame or threaten you out of conservative convictions. But if you look back through church history, I think about the rise of like German higher criticism and whatnot, there is a sort of fashionable, when you talk about the Overton window, there's a fashionable sense of who is to be respected. Mm-hmm. And conservatives kind of cave to that because they're glad to trade their convictions for reputation in certain circles. Oh, man.
Yeah. Have I used the Bob Jones quote on here before?
Oh, I don't think so. Lay it out.
So Bob Jones was, the founder of Bob Jones University, mm-hmm. was a fundamentalist guy. And he always said the evangelical is the one who will say to the liberal, "I'll call you a Christian if you'll call me a scholar."
Yes, and amen. So I heard that from one of my heroes named W.A. Criswell.
Oh, you know what? It may have originated with him. I heard it from Bob Jones, but he may have been quoting him.
Well, a good idea.
Yeah, those guys were all running around in the same circles anyway at that point.
Right, and that's exactly it. And I would call that a kind of cowardice. If you're going to trade your convictions, what you say are your convictions, for reputation, right. I think that's a kind of cowardice. And so I landed on institutional bravery. The other side of this is that these are the kind of institutions that conservatives need to work for, so that when the mob comes for them as an individual, the institution, whatever weight it has, can say back to the mob, "We're not moving. Try this somewhere else." Right?
Yeah.
And so you need your school or your college or your church or whatever it is, your think tank. It needs to be brave as well, not just the individuals, but the institution.
Yeah. So there's almost two kinds of bravery that we're talking here. We're talking about here. You're talking about the institution's bravery to protect the men in the institution, but you're also talking about the individual bravery of each man in that institution to protect the institution itself.
Absolutely. I mean, they've got to feed each other, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing I was trying to think about. I think a lot of people are actually wondering, how do you keep organizations and institutions from moving leftward? How do I find a place that will stand with me when the mob comes? But I don't think there's been a ton of great answers proposed. And so I started trying to at least start the ball rolling down the hill on that. Is that enough intro?
Well, yeah, but I need to know more. What conclusions did you come to?
Okay, well, let me sketch out the outline, and maybe you can tell me what you think is more interesting on that. It feels, I feel like I'm doing a bit of navel-gazing as I work through my own material.
No, go for it.
But the thesis that I'm working with, you'll often hear the principle described as Robert Conquest's second law of politics. The digging I did into this, I think it actually showed up first from a guy named John O'Sullivan. It was his first law of organization. But you've probably heard it, listener, if none of that's familiar to you, you've probably heard the phrasing, "Any organization not explicitly right-wing sooner or later becomes left-wing." And so I think that's an observably true principle. I think that's empirically demonstrable from history. And so thinking about how to be explicitly right leaning and right moving, even as the Overton continues to drift left, the outline of principles I came up with first, and I'm going to use the term school because that's what I was thinking about when I wrote this, is that your school is only as good as its documents. And so you should have a historic confession. But I also think a group that wants to fight leftward drift doesn't just need a static confession, because most of those wars were fought in a time frame that doesn't cost anyone today anything.
Yeah.
And contemporary liberals, at least in evangelical groups, are happy to say, "Oh, yes, I agree with that confession."
Right.
As a way to kind of mask them or hide themselves from accusations of accuracy where people call them, "Hey, you're a liberal."
Yeah. Two things I was just thinking of as you said that. One is having a confession like that, especially one that explicitly lines out the issues of the day, is very helpful for your employees, because when they get attacked by the state or by some other group, they can point back to, no, I have these convictions for this reason. The institution I work for has these convictions. And you see this a lot in churches. And because it's so old, oftentimes that will be respected more by, you know, like a court or something like that. I've seen cases where people will argue, hey, we need to put this in our constitution so that if someone comes against us legally, they have a standing to argue, well, actually, I'm following the constitution of my organization in believing this thing and following this rule. So that's one helpful reason to have that. And then the second thing I was thinking of, which I can't remember now, what was the last thing you said?
Well, that I was basically taking a shot at these guys who will say, hey, I'm a conservative because I agree with some document from the 17th century.
Right. We saw, and we may have even mentioned this on the show in like the first episode, but we saw that recently with like, there was a transgender person who was like, well, I affirm the Nicene Creed. I'm Orthodox.
That's so, exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These ancient documents, which are great and incredibly helpful mm-hmm. and foundational to Christianity, are not always enough, especially as the world just gets more and more insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you've got these guys who are heroes in battles that were won long before they were ever alive. And they're complete cowards and betrayers in the actual theological controversies of their moment. And so it is important to have that historic confession for just the reason you said. It tells, and I don't know how much of a bulwark this actually is, but it tells any court that's going to get involved, these people are self-consciously working from a tradition that's much older than whatever this contemporary controversy is. I mean, we can't really probably do it this way, but the Amish and the Mennonites are examples of this, where the state has been like, you know what, leave them alone. They've been doing this. If we could appropriate some of that, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
The element I added, though, and I really do think this is important to institutions, families, you know, churches, whatever, I think within that heading of being only as good as your documents is that you have to self-consciously embrace being reactionary. And that's hard for people who are part of the kind of ancient tradition that we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We want to kind of say our tradition, and in a profitable way, I'm not despising this, but we want to say I'm part of something that predates your petty concerns. And that adds stability. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
But we are in contemporary fights, and those things have to be addressed.
Right. And I think Presbyterianism is a great example of the error you're trying to point out here, or at least we're guilty of it more often than, say, Baptists are. And that is because we have such an old tradition, and we've got I don't want to use the word bureaucracy because it's, you know, a negative word. But we have a system in place for dealing with these kinds of things. You have the church courts and the presbyteries and the general assembly, and you have, like, you know, the book of order ready for you to figure out how to run these meetings and how to deal with these issues. It's very easy to just be a very slow moving organization, which in a lot of ways is really a good thing, like you were saying. Like it's good to have that mm-hmm. strong foundation and not move quick from it. However, especially in the world we're living in today, where social media runs everything, by the time Presbyterianism gets to the hot button issue, the fight's already over. Half of your congregation already believes and approves of the thing that you now have to deal with, and they are going to topple your organization from the ground up. Like, it doesn't matter now if the General Assembly decides something. You've already lost the people.
Mm. Well, I really do want to talk to you about the General Assembly at some point, because in a lot of ways, I look on your system with envy. I mean, I'm a congregationalist by theological conviction, but I look on your system and I see the wisdom in it and the resources it offers. But since we're talking about Presbyterianism, I think Revoice is a wonderful example of what I'm calling for.
Yeah.
They know how to use the language that lets them nest themselves within some outward appearance of conforming to the confessional tradition. And they're like a rot that sits up on a tree masking itself as bark. By the time you realize that's a fungus rather than bark, the tree is already compromised, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say being reactionary, I think organizations should be, what I wrote is go where the battles are being fought and pick a fight. And so addressing Revoice, addressing how dangerous big tech is to Christian discipleship, how Disney, watching Disney is a matter of Christian faithfulness at this point. Like, it's not just critical race theory and Revoice. It's some of the very practical things that happen within your people's households.
Yeah.
You need to be addressing that. The CREC does a good job of this. Their governing body will issue kind of position papers. Our church has tried to do some of this. For instance, our elders issued a statement that our congregation formally voted to affirm, decrying the practice of sending women to active combat.
Yeah.
And, I don't know if that's going to stand up in court, but I do want to be able to look at a magistrate if they overreach and say, hey, that guy who's refusing to let his daughter report for the draft, we're coming after him. I want to be able to stand in front of them and say, no, before you maniacs got to this point, we knew y'all were coming and we already said you're crazy and we want nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know that it's going to stand up, but that's the kind of reactionary that I think you need to be. Get on the record.
Even if it's not good enough for the state, they're still going to overreach, which they will eventually, no matter what. It is good in that it disciples your people.
Mm-hmm.
When you take the stand, your people are going to learn from that. That's one of the best ways to disciple people is if you're, a church leader or a leader of an institution or the leader of a family. The best way to disciple those under you is to actually, have a spine, have a backbone and stand up about these things and react to them immediately. And maybe you react too harshly at first against something, but that's better than not reacting at all and just letting it consume, your family, church, or school.
Absolutely, man. I would take the overreaction over the lack thereof. Absolutely right. I'll tell you, just pastorally, it was really profitable for our church because it helped clarify some things within brothers who were already kind of based, but I think were misreading the idea of women in the draft. So some of these brothers were sort of taking this as, the memes where it's like, feminists when a hot war breaks out and they're in heels and pearls cleaning the house.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Right. Yeah. It's guys who kind of saw it through that lens to say, wait a minute, these chicks want equality. They're telling us how they can do everything a man can do just as well. And now we're going to show up and say, well, you don't actually have to go face real bullets. How is that consistent? And what I could say to them is, no, man, listen, we're not reacting to feminism on the front of, well, y'all are going to have to find out what it's like. We're Christians. We know what a woman is for. We know what a man is for. And so, by design, ontologically, this is inappropriate. Feminism is also inappropriate. Feminism that wants to gesture towards these things, that's inappropriate too. But we're not... we're not driven by that. We're actually thinking about this as Christians. And as soon as we had the conversation, everybody squared up really quick. But if I hadn't run into these guys on this issue, that would be happening in my church and I wouldn't have known about it. So it was very profitable.
You could almost say, given what you're talking about now, you could almost say it's not just being reactionary, but being proactive about addressing these things. You're not just reacting to them when they arise, but you're trying to get out ahead of them. So that when the problem
that's a great
comes,
point, yeah,
you've already dealt with it.
Yes. The reason I think of it as reactionary is that the culture is churning up so much craziness all the time that I don't feel like the Christians are always leading on addressing every moment because the culture is under such judgment and it is debasing itself so quickly that you're constantly having to be like, okay, this is on the horizon. I better address that. And so you're right that you want to be proactive as much as is possible. This idea actually came to me as I was thinking about my own family and counseling the young parents in my church. And this is where I think probably, if you're not running an institution, this is where I think the rubber will meet for a lot of our listeners. You do want to be proactive in the sense that you want to be the first voice at the table on any hot button issue with your children. You want the bad guys to always be a reaction to you in the minds and hearts of the people in your family. So this gets icky for parents, but my kids need to hear about why pride parades are godless and despicable before they ever hear about a pride parade from anyone else. I want dad's voice to be the first voice there so that when whoever else is addressing is doing so, they're doing it after I have set the table. Now, my kids may reject it. My kids may embrace wickedness, but I want them to do it knowing they're crawling over dad's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think another thing to think about is I think sometimes Christian parents, even in like fundamentalist or like conservative circles, have a certain naivete about this that, you know, your kids are in Christian school. They're not hearing about this kind of thing. That's not true.
Right.
Like if they have an iPad, an iPhone, any kind of smart device, they're hearing about these.
If their friends do too.
Right.
Right.
And if not, they're still hearing about it at school. Or even in church, you know, when they're hanging out with their friends. Yeah. The sheltering thing doesn't work, and it's not going to work.
Well, I'm with you on this, but I would just say the sheltering thing works in that it gives you an opportunity to be the first voice at the table.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Sheltering alone
doesn't work.
Right. Right. So again, listener, just as an example from my own family, I've got a kid who's old enough to be approaching puberty. But I actually wasn't thinking about having the talk with this child because of puberty. You know, you can start growing hair without needing dad to explain to you how sex works. For, you know, there's a window there where that's not relevant. But what I knew was it's not just puberty. His classmates are going through puberty. A bunch of them have smartphones. I need to talk to him about porn.
Yeah.
And so we had to have the sex talk a little bit earlier than I would have developmentally talked with my child about that, because I knew porn was going to be coming at him quicker than basically his own sexual appetites were going to be.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was an awkward conversation. I do think just developmentally, probably in an isolated world, we should have had that maybe as much as a year or two later. But because I knew porn was coming from, I wanted to be the first voice at the table about what's going to show up on your friend's smartphones. My kids don't have smartphones, and they won't. Unless they surreptitiously, you know, acquire one on their own or something.
Yeah.
But their classmates at a Christian school do. And so I knew I just got to get ahead of that. That's what I mean about being the first voice at the table. It's going to accelerate your timetable a little bit. You have to be creative about addressing these things in a way that's developmentally appropriate. But the bad guys are coming for your family. And you darn well better see that as a credible threat and get ahead of it. And that's true for churches and schools and all kinds of places.
Yeah. And I think one thing that you just said that's really important is that it's going to lead to some awkward conversations, For sure. where you're going to, whether it's your family or whatever institution it is, you're going to be like, why do I have to be this guy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I especially think of this with just like church related issues and things like that, because I've had to have some conversations in the past where I'm like, I am not the contentious church member. I try very hard not to be insufferable. When I, you know me, I could be easily. So I try very hard not to be. And you reach a certain point where it's like, okay, well, we have to have this conversation. Why do I have to be the one to have this conversation? And yet, so you have to have some uncomfortable conversations. You have to take some stands that people are going to think you're a little ridiculous for taking stands on, for asking questions about. And that can be a hard thing, because it feels like there's this constant, like, oh, here we go again. I have to be that guy. But it's for the best, like, especially thinking in terms of your family, you know, it's like, oh, do I really have to have this conversation?
Mm-hmm.
But the end result could be saving your son's soul.
Yeah, for sure. I'll give you another example that I want to communicate to parents who feel like this is a difficult calling. I want to say it is a difficult calling, and I'm not saying that from a place of ignorance. So a few years ago, my kids had been to Disneyland. One day we were in the area, a relative was there and said, hey, let me take your kids to Disney. We went for a day, and they were all getting about the age that a Disney trip was something their classmates were doing. Normally this would be the time you take the Disney trip. But for our family, that was such a significant financial cost that I had told them, we're going to have to all go in on this together. So I picked up another part-time job for the year to put some money back towards it. But I told them, like, you're going to want to spend money. You guys need to be looking for ways to make some money where you can. You also need to be asking relatives expressly, hey, this year, because we're planning to go to Disney, can I have money for my birthday or for Christmas? So we did this for a year. And that was about the time that Disney was going crazy. I can't remember what time frame. It was probably around the time, I think it was called Onward came out, where there was this scene. I say Onward.
Is that Russell Moore's book?
It may be. I mean, might as well be. We're talking about the same set of demons. But it was the Chris Pratt movie where it was a brilliant movie in a lot of ways, because they live in this magical world, but it has become disenchanted, and their hunger for their father is going to lead them back into an enchanted world. I mean, it was a glorious movie, but Disney intentionally inserted a lesbian character to say something about her girlfriend. And it's arbitrary. It stands out like a sore thumb in the movie, but they had done that. And they had also signaled something else that I was like, you know what? Disney is identifying itself as a bad guy to me. And they're coming for my family. And if I take them to Disney, they are going to have specific memories from our family life about it's not just going to be that Disney had cool rides and they got to meet a princess or a Star Wars character, but that's going to be bound up in these sweet, what I hope are sweet memories of our family taking trips together. And I cannot let Disney have that kind of heft to use against my kids, right? I don't want my kids having positive, sentimental relationship to Disney, as Disney's clearly signaling that they want to destroy my family.
Yeah.
So after we saved up for a year, I set my kids down and I said, we're not going to Disney. And they had worked and they had asked. Mm. And I mean, it was a heavy family meeting. And we were sad, and we were sad for a long time. But what has become, what's the fruit of that so far? This isn't a magic bullet. It's not going to fix everything. But you know who is hypersensitive to the nonsense coming out of Disney that they hear from their friends? My kids.
Yeah.
It cost my kids something to make a break with Disney. And so now they see Disney as the enemy that it is. It's a net win, but man, it was really tough to get there.
Yeah. And I think, too, that's going to bear a lot of fruit in the future, because while it may have seemed like a large thing to them at the time, it was really, a small thing to not go to Disney when you want to go to Disney. But it builds that muscle of, these people are our enemies. They want to destroy us, and they are against the gospel of Christ. So we can't have anything to do with them.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So it felt big. It was weighty, and it was worth doing.
Yeah.
And so that's what I mean when I tell, listener, when I'm telling you these things, it's not like I've not practiced some of this in a way that really hurt. It's a first world problem. Don't get me wrong. I realize that this isn't like, giving a kidney to a church member, but it hurt. I would make the decision 7 times out of 7 if given the opportunity. It paid off.
So here's a question about that. What things do you think you can do in a situation like that to lead your kids to think of Disney as the bad guy and not dad?
Well, we'd done some preparatory work. Now, listeners, you may know that I do a podcast with Jared Moore called Pop Culture Cormdale. So my family loves family movie night. We were Disney Plus subscribers when it first rolled out. I mean, we're pretty deep in those pop culture waters. So on this specific issue, we never really watched a movie that we didn't talk through. Mm. I would set up like, hey, here's the reason I picked this for family movie night. Or when a kid came and asked, could we watch this? I would say, hey, when this child gave me the recommendation, here's how I decided, yeah, this would be good. Here's some things I want you to look for. And I would, I'd try to kind of pre-stage it to say, this is some, without spoilers, these are some great things to look forward to in this movie. Here's some things you're going to want to be careful about. Sometimes in a movie, if it was particularly egregious or noteworthy, we'll pause it which is not what we want to do most of the time. Because when you're watching a movie, you just want to hear a story and be lost in the world a little bit.
Yeah.
But sometimes we would pause it and talk about it. Definitely by the time the movie was over, either right after or the next time we had family dinner, we'd talk about the movie and I would highlight, okay, now you know the specifics. Did you see that, with whatever that was, Onward or whatever, did you notice when she said her girlfriend? Because I told him, like, there's this pro-gay thing in here that I want y'all to be on the lookout for. And several of them caught it. A couple of them didn't that were younger, particularly because the character is sort of androgynous. And we would walk through, hey, do you see that Disney wants you to think of this as normal? Should we think of these things as normal? And at least in that sense. Now, again, none of my kids are adults now. They may look back and embrace like a Kristen Dumez thing where every good thing your Christian parents try to do for you is suddenly now some reason you're supposed to hate them. That's on the table.
Yeah.
But so far, my kids have been pretty willing to say, my dad takes care of me. My dad loves me. My dad's not an idiot. And he's got a credible narrative here of what Disney's trying to do to our family.
Yeah.
Not to just stay on this forever, but one thing I have regularly told my children since they were very young is, guys, your family's different. It's going to cost you some things. We want to do these other things to help you sort of feel like there was also really good things about our family that other families didn't have to. But I've told them explicitly, you're going to meet lots of people in important places in society, the kind of people that you want to like you and that you will feel like looking up to, who will tell you that I, as your dad, am a monster because of the things that I've tried to mark out as distinct within our family.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to make the decision, was my dad a monster? Was my dad hateful? Was my dad brainwashing me? You're going to have to make that decision. And I can't make it for you. And particularly because you're going to see things that I have gotten very wrong that I don't know what they're going to be right now. I'm not planning to do anything wrong to you. But someday you're going to look back and be like, man, dad didn't do that as well as he could have. Some people are going to tell you that is how you know I'm a monster. And you need to be ready to make that decision. And so, I tried to frame it out. This is actually going to happen. These are the ways I want you to see the world as it's sending you messages. And someday you're going to have to make a decision on, was I credible and helpful, or was I some kind of, whatever, again, Demez would describe me as. You're going to have to make that decision.
So, what you're saying, what you're describing right now is your first point in your talk here. You got to be reactive and proactive.
Yeah.
Get ahead of the issue. Like, talk about it right away.
Yep.
Don't let the enemy set the stage of the battle for you.
For sure. And look, movie night's a great night, because my conscience is clear on this, and I think I'm in conformity with the Word of God.
Yeah.
But when I'm feeding my kids pizza and giving them M&Ms afterward, and I'm saying, hey, some of the things I'm telling you here, the world is going to tell you I'm a monster for, they're going to, when they remember that conversation, if they do, it's going to be like, oh yeah, dad was feeding us treats, and dad rejoiced to give us good things, and he was always looking for opportunities to surprise us with something good, we'll see how it plays out, but that's what I've been trying to do.
No, that's really good. I want to talk a little bit about something you have in here, and we've talked about this somewhat before, but never as explicitly as you did in this talk, and that is we ought to laugh at what God laughs at.
Man, I'm glad you brought that, because I feel like that's the most controversial part of
yes, and this. I love it. I think it's fantastic. So go ahead and just outline what you mean by that. We ought to laugh at what God laughs at.
Okay, so this comes under the second point. So the second point in the talk is that your school is only as good as your people, meaning your leaders and employees. And that comes after documents, because you can have great documents, but if nobody in the organization is willing to practice them when it's difficult, you might as well not have them. So you have to have people who are willing to say, yeah, this is super costly, but I'm not giving on our social media policy or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And so as you think about cultivating those kind of people, one of the things that I think is neglected is laughing at the lunacy of the wicked. And Ben, if it's okay with you, I want to read just a couple paragraphs here to lay this out.
Yeah, go for it.
Because I think this is where I have a real high burden of proof to meet. So what I wrote is, as for training your own leaders, yes, start with cultivating deep affections for what is true and good and beautiful. What I want to add is that you need to have a culture of rejoicing in natural law. So what that would look like is celebrating weddings, finding out that someone is pregnant and throwing a little party because pregnancy and babies are good things. You need to have a culture of rejoicing in natural law, and you need to have a culture of having a laugh in the least winsome way possible at those who would pervert those good things and destroy others who join them. I mean that you need to laugh at the perverts regularly. This is an underappreciated pedagogical method. I mean that without any sense of irony. This tactic has been used against normal people for at least my adult lifetime. It is very difficult to treat some idea or position or person with seriousness after you have had a real laugh at its expense. Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Saturday Night Live, John Oliver, all of them have been showing us how powerful this technique is, and yet we find ourselves in a time where drag queen story hour is increasingly part of our civic life, and yet the laughable ridiculousness of the whole thing is something we're not supposed to notice. So a friend told me recently that one of the ways to agree with God is to laugh at what he laughs at. Remember that Christ laughs at the nations that attempt to cast off his authority according to Psalm 2. Remember too that God himself laughs at the wicked according to Psalm 37. So we want to be as gentle as possible with people generally. You know, I'm not going to be gentle with Greg Johnson.
Can you read that Psalm 37 passage just in case people aren't as familiar with that one? I think most people know the Psalm 2 one, but...
Yeah, okay. So Psalm 37, I'm thinking about 12 through 15 is the specific verses. The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him, but the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. The wicked draw their sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and needy, slay those whose way is upright. That's our day. That's what the wicked are doing. And the Lord is laughing at them.
Yeah, for the specific reason that he knows what their end is going to be.
Right, right. And we can join him in that. That's one of the ways we can agree with God, right?
Yeah.
So where I was going with that is you want to be as gentle as possible with people. So like when the brothers show up and say, hey, man, we think women ought to go to the draft because that's equal treatment. That's what they say they want. I'm not going to immediately start laughing at them. But Greg Johnson shows up and says, hey, Presbyterians should embrace sodomy. I'm going to laugh at that. And so I wrote, you should intentionally scoff at mockers. There's Elijah on Mount Carmel. The text that really stood out to me, Ben, as I was compiling this, is it's in Proverbs. It's chapter 1, verses 24 through 27. And there, wisdom incarnate laughs at the calamity of those who reap what their foolishness has sown. So what that text tells us is that when their house is collapsed on top of them because of their foolishness, wisdom shows up and doesn't offer a helping hand. She laughs at them. Proverbs chapter 3, 33 through 34 says, the Lord is scornful toward the scornful, the wickedly scornful. Christ mocked Herod and the Pharisees. You know, when Christ calls Herod that fox, we think of that on the far side of Eve's fable where the fox is sort of seen as this clever creature. But that wasn't what the Hebrew mind had in mind. They were scavenger animals like vultures.
Yeah, I think we've talked about that specific metaphor on an episode before.
Yeah, so when Christ is doing that, he's talking about the representative of Rome in the Holy Land, and he's calling him a vulture. And telling him, basically, you have no power over me. You're just a filthy scavenger. Tell the Pharisees I'll do what I want. And so that is one of the things that I think we need to do. We need to find the maniacs, the men who are walking around major downtown areas in gimp masks with a ball in their mouth, and laugh at them like crazy. Yes, it's disgusting. Yes, it is mournful because that's an image bearer debasing themselves in sin. It's also comically ridiculous.
Yeah.
And we should have a rich laugh at that.
Yeah. I think about this in terms of, because, you know, I feel like we may have had this exact conversation on here before on a different episode, but I'm just going to say it again. I think of this in terms of social media. You know, people are always like, oh, the memes never accomplish anything. All of this foolish, you know, joking around never accomplishes anything. Well, no, actually, that's not true. It accomplishes a lot. And one key thing it accomplishes is it makes people who are afraid to say something realize it's okay to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is actually, this is ridiculous.
Yes.
And it's okay to laugh.
Yes.
I've said it a few days ago about the whole G3 thing, which, you know, I made some memes about that and some videos that got a lot of play. And what I said was, you know, nobody wanted it to be that way. But sometimes mm-hmm. what you're doing when you make a video or a meme like that, you're not really attacking. You're really holding up a mirror and just saying, mm-hmm. you know, this is how you're behaving. You look like this. And I think we've talked about before the Jonathan Pageau using the example of the jester.
Mm-hmm.
The jester
setting the world back.
He flips the world upside down. But when the world's upside down, he's actually putting it back into right order.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. The other thing, so at this point, when I gave the talk at the ACCS, and I guess I need to just say that, you know, my talk does not necessarily reflect the thoughts and concepts of the ACCS, you know, they're not right on the hook for what I said. But I started getting some questions in the app that they provide for the audience to give you questions on your talk. And this is where I think I started kind of offending people, because they were saying, how can you love someone that you're laughing at? How can mm-hmm. it be an act of love to laugh at someone? And so my response to that is, and this may be a uniquely male phenomenon, I'm not sure women do this, but having a good laugh is also an invitation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have been, you know, my critics are not going to be surprised by this. I've been in a lot of situations where in a group of friends, I am the butt of the joke. And somebody's having a good laugh at something ridiculous I've done. Now, I think that kind of bullying is super profitable. I think we need more kind of peer-to-peer bullying in that sense. It's been very useful in shaping my character and rounding off parts of me that needed to be rounded off. You know, you can sull up and get mad and feel triggered and wounded and all these, you know, pop psychology terms that escape, that allow you sort of this escape from having to deal with your own ridiculousness. Or you can say, okay, that was really ridiculous. I'll join you.
Yeah.
And that's loving.
I read, I want to say it was in Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life that he talks about this.
Oh, really?
Which I read years ago, and so I can't remember if it was under a specific rule or not. But basically, he talks about how workplace bullying or joking oftentimes is exactly how a person who has some kind of severe social disorder corrects it, because they're around a bunch of other guys who are kind of, like you said, kind of cutting the rough edges off, smoothing the rough edges off, because they're sort of in a playful, jesting way, sometimes less playful and more like actually trying to hurt you. But in mm-hmm. in a real way, they are showing you the socially unacceptable things you are doing.
Absolutely right, man. And it's an invitation to not have to, you know, you don't have to reject everything about who you are.
Yeah.
You can say, okay, that is ridiculous. This has been helpful. I'll reject that part and grow through it.
Yeah. Or, you know, or they may be wrong. Sure. And so you just say, no.
Like, or you fire back and make fun of their ridiculous, you know, that, I mean,
yeah.
These are things
this is definitely a masculine thing, though. This is not how women behave with each other.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, I grew up on farms and locker rooms, and not everything there was spiritually helpful, but this stuff was.
Yeah. I mean, I think about one of the jobs I've had in the past. I worked in a feed mill. We worked 14-hour days every other day. So from 5 a.m. to 7 p.m., you were with the same crew of guys. And the amount of just like bullying and tearing each other down that happened during those 14 hours, because nobody wanted to be there for 14 hours. You started your shift at 5 in the morning. I don't think anybody even talked to each other until 10. Because we were all just so angry that we had to be there at 5 in the morning at a feed mill. And then, you know, there's just constant, you know, language I can't repeat on this podcast being thrown back and forth between everybody. But at the end of the day, you were a part of a crew and you all kind of had each other's back. And if the other crew had said anything about your crew, like the other day's shift, there would have been a war on your behalf.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. All that to say that this kind of, I'm hesitant to use the word bullying, because there is a real kind of, you know, bullying that leads to, you know, like suicide and things like that, that is bad. But this kind of bullying is actually really helpful, especially for young men. I mean, it'll teach you how to be a man.
That's entirely correct. And honestly, it probably hardens you for the wrong kind of bullying as well.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
You develop enough of a thick skin to kind of cast that stuff away from you when it's not helpful. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think moms can practice this. I think lots of different people can practice this. I think you can have a good laugh at ridiculousness. You know, I think it was Michelle Williams who a couple years ago, she stood up to receive some kind of reward and said that this wouldn't be possible if I hadn't had an abortion. And outrage is the appropriate response for that. There is also a very appropriate response of sadness because an image bearer was destroyed and an image bearer was defiled.
Yeah.
And, you know, and whatever she thinks she's gaining. But it is also ridiculous to look at a woman created for the purpose of, in the most glorious fashion, bearing children, producing more image bearers, to say, I'm happy to trade a child for this little gold-plated statue that someday will be auctioned off with my estate.
Yeah.
That, you know, once you get through the outrage, once you get through the once you get through the sadness, that, you know, then you can also say, that is worse than the person on the street corner who says the CIA is listening to his thoughts through the sun.
Yeah. Do you realize really how stupid this. You sound?
Right. Look at what you have traded, idiot, you know?
Yeah.
Isaiah does this where he says, like, you go out in the woods and you cut down a tree and you take half of it and you say, I'm going to cook my meal on this. And the other half, you say, I'm going to worship this.
Yep.
I mean, that's Michelle Williams. And so I do think you ought to be looking for places to have a laugh at the wicked morons.
Yeah.
All
right. Do you want to, let's see here. All right. So pause. What else do we want to cover in this?
Hit the idea that we should mortify the desire or successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We'll do that.
And then I'm done.
Wrap it up from there. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I do want to talk about, although, man, we've already, that stuff on the family movie time was so good. We've already kind of talked about it, but we should talk about how do you apply these things to not just, you know, a school, but your family or your church or, you know, any other institution. That can be our concluding remarks.
That sounds great. I've got some, you know, we do that at church too. So yeah, I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
Great. Let me just pick up with that last one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Ben, we've went pretty long on this. I'm sure we need to wrap it up. The third point of three on my talk was that your school is only as good as its ambitions. What do you want to be? Do you want to be the biggest, coolest school? Do you want to be the most interesting Christian parachurch thing in your town? Do you want to be the headmaster of a huge school? And we've talked about this before, so I'm not going to belabor the point. But the desire to be liked and to have huge numbers is basically how evangelicals are always pulled away into unfaithfulness.
Yeah.
And so it's really important to mortify any ambition you have that isn't faithfulness. The ambition you want to have is, I have been faithful to what God has revealed in His Word best I know how in these circumstances. And every other ambition basically needs to die. And then you need to train your people to do that too.
Yeah. And as important, you know, as a, in a school institution, how important is that in a family as well? What do you want your family to be? What is your ambition for your family? Is it to be, you know, extremely wealthy, to have, you know, the popular kids who do well in sports and are, you know, going to make it someday?
Hey, to get real practical with our listeners, to be seen as the model Christian family, right? That's a snare.
Yeah.
I mean, I want my family to carry a sense of respect. But if I'm trying to have a family that everybody looks at and says, gosh, I wish my family was that, whatever. I mean, if that's a fruit that God blesses with, that's fine. but I need to spend no time paying any attention.
Yeah. And in fact, you'll get that by not paying attention to it.
That's sure.
That's the way you get that.
For sure. I'm just saying, when it shows up, pretend like you never heard it. You know, just kill that thing, because it's going to ask you to crave that, and you don't want to.
Yeah. It's a kind of wanting to be respectable, but within the smaller circle of Christian life. It's like, well, I want other people to think well of me.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. So yeah, that stuff's got to die. It has to be faithfulness as the sole metric by which you evaluate whatever endeavor you're getting yourself to. And that is the end of the highlights of my talk, if they can be described as highlights.
I mean, the entire thing can be described as highlights. I can't say enough good things about this talk. Is it recorded? Like, can people listen to this anywhere?
We're going to find out, Ben, because they had me run a webinar recording.
Okay.
But they never give you, as far as I can tell, based on talking to other people who presented, the ACCS never comes to you and it's like, hey, that was great, or that was awful. You kind of find out what the reception was when you pitch another idea.
If they post it or not.
If they post it, or if you pitch another idea and they're like, yeah, you can come talk some more.
Okay.
So it's supposed to be recorded. If it is, I'll be happy to run it out. If they, you know, if they release it, I'm sure there's some kind of agreement where they have rights to the recording.
Right.
But it's my talk. I can give my own version of that anytime I want to.
Yeah. Well, you definitely should, because that it's really good.
Well, that means all the world to me, man. It I never really know when someone is just being polite, but when a thoughtful brother like you, who wouldn't care to tell me I'm stupid,
who's never going to be just polite,
yes, right, who will profitably bully me, that means a lot coming. See, here again, I've told my wife version of this too. I've told her, I was like, honey, I'm never going to do the thing where I'm like, hey, you look lovely, if I don't think you do. If she says, hey, how does this dress look? I'm going to say, I think that pattern's weird, or it doesn't.
Yeah.
If that's the case. Because I want my compliments to actually carry weight.
Right. I have said to my wife before, you're going to know that I'm never lying to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm just going to tell you what's true.
Like, yeah.
You'll never have to worry if I'm lying to you about it.
Right. I'm not going to do it in hateful fashion or mean-spirited, right? I mean, I'm going to consider my wife's frame.
Yeah.
But I'm going to answer forthrightly, because when I tell you, gosh, you look gorgeous tonight, I want her to go, gosh, he really thinks I look gorgeous tonight.
Right.
So, I don't know, Ben, you want to talk about practical application?
Yeah, all throughout this episode, we've been really talking about this, but you gave this talk in the context of a Christian school, but the principles you are describing are applicable to any institution. You know, a church, family, I mean, even in a way, civil government, like any institution, these principles are true. What are some ways, and we've talked about it a little bit already, but what are some ways you think that these principles can be applied to families? Because I think that for our listeners is going to be the key institution that they're thinking about. Like, how do I, as a father or as a mother, put these principles into play in my family?
Yeah. Well, there's some stuff that I didn't get to in the talk. Like, the actual thesis is you have to be explicit repeatedly and even aggressive about identifying yourself as a right-wing institution.
Yeah.
So I think with your family, they need to have the vocabulary that runs the contemporary debates. So my family knows that I, and by extension, they, because of our mutual, are not liberals, we're conservatives.
Yeah.
My family, even at a pretty young age, know that the GOP often is the closest thing to what represents our values, but we are not beholden to them, because they also regularly show they're compromised.
Yeah.
So, like, some stuff that happens in my house a lot is my kids, who are getting older, they're talking with their kids about contemporary events, they will come and say something about, did you know XYZ happened? And, you know, me, Ben, and it's the same for you. Yeah, I know. So I say things like, I can't stand liberals. They ruin everything. That's a broad brush.
Yeah.
But when my kids are pretty young, they need me to paint with really bright, bold lines.
Yeah.
Now, when my kids get to be 18, 19, 20, I'm going to thread that needle a little bit. I'm going to talk about differences between Donald Trump and DeSantis. But as they're younger, they need to know where the boundaries are that life can be found within and danger is found without, right?
Yep.
So that's one way. Anything that comes to your mind?
Well, just thinking about what you just said, you tell your kids not to cross the street, not because crossing the street is bad, but because right now you need the protection. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you're doing that with the aim that someday they will know how to safely cross the street on their own.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So one of the things I was thinking about with especially the being explicitly right wing, and I think of right wing, you know, not just politically, which I'm sure you mean this too. We're talking, you know, conservative in the sense of theologically, just socially is too trite of a word for what I mean, but socially conservative. And, you know, years ago, I read an article on the blog when it was much bigger than it is now. I don't even know if it still exists anymore. The Art of Manliness. Do you remember that blog? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm still subscribed to the podcast.
Oh, okay. So they're still going?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah. They wrote an article years ago about having a family culture and like being intentional about creating a family culture. Like, this is what our family believes. This is who we are as the Woodrings or the Wrights or, you know. And I think there's something valuable about that, because just like a church needs a constitution or a confession or a, you know, a business needs to have their constitution, like their governing documents, a family needs that too. Like, who are we as a family? What do we stand for? What do we believe? So that when the individual situation comes along, it's not going to be a surprise. Your kids are going to know, well, actually, I'm a Woodring and Woodrings don't do that.
Yep. Yeah, man, what that looks like in our household is that we tell our kids rights make things better. It's a way for me to say, like, reforming is at the DNA of what we are. And so if we find a house, we make the house better. If we have a piece of land, we make the land better. If we have a church, we make the church better. Again, that's it's framed, hopefully, in a way that's approachable for a young child, but also expandable. And the... you know, the project here is actually to hand off for multiple generations. You're talking about family culture. That's what that means, right? We want this to be our great-great-grandkids, if the Lord is pleased to do that. And so from a very young age, we would talk to our children under the assumption that they will someday raise children. And so we'll say things like, hey, when you're a dad, one of the things you're going to have to do is remember that you want to be your kid's friend, but you're not primarily your you're there to help him know how to honor God in the world. And that's doing two things with my kids. It's one, telling them what they should expect from me. I want to be your friend, but my primary goal is to help you know how to know your Creator and serve him well. But it's also getting their imagination, hopefully, jump-started to say, yeah, how would I do that for my kids? And to dream of themselves as parents.
Yep. How do you think, well, I think we've already answered this. I was going to say, how do you think the principle of, you know, laughing at what God laughs at applies itself in a family? But really, I think the way we discussed that question to begin with is directly applicable to families. When you see ridiculous sin, you laugh at it as though it is ridiculous.
Yeah. Cause
if you have an example of something like this, that would be great.
Yeah, so one of the things that's happened with our family, because we talk about these things, I've pointed out to them, hey, look, you'll never see a white heterosexual couple on an advertisement again. If you do, note that company and buy stuff from them. Not because it's some kind of white supremacist endeavor, but because they're not ashamed of the natural family and they're not ashamed of saying, oh, look, white people sometimes marry each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember somebody mentioned that to me a long time ago. And, you know, I don't have a TV, so I don't really see a lot of advertising, but I, you know, we'll see ads online sometimes. And it is interesting that it's very rare that you'll see just a, like, if it is a white couple, they're usually gay.
Right.
But you won't see just a normal white family.
Yep. It's interracial, which, I mean, you know, this is where you insert the trademark. Not that there's anything wrong with that,
right. Yeah.
But it's just gone. And so, like, my kids like to watch sports. We have told them in sports, the danger is almost always going to come from the advertising or from whatever messaging the athlete is doing outside of the competition.
Mm-hmm.
So now my kids, without my prompting, because we've done versions of this, will say, we've got a string of commercials coming up in this commercial break. How many of the families do you think will be either interracial or gay? And they'll be like, well, I think it'll be 3-2 or 1-5. And as they're watching it, they're playing kind of a bingo,
yeah.
Which delights me. That's exactly what I want going on in their minds and hearts.
Right. Right. I'm trying to think of a way to describe this, but especially with sports now, it has actually moved beyond just the advertising and things around it. I can't remember if it was right after COVID, like the first baseball game after COVID. I was like thinking, I think I'll start watching baseball. That'll be a fun thing to get into. It doesn't seem like it's super politicized like football's getting. Mm-hmm. So I sit down to watch the opening game, and they've got like all of the players surrounding the field holding this, like, I think it was a black like piece of fabric, and it was stretched all the way around the field, and they were all on their knees, and it was some, you know, religious display for the Black Lives Matter movement. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, we can't just have a baseball game. We have to have a religious ceremony beforehand. And it's not even my religion.
Yep. That's exactly what it was, man. So, I mean, those kind of things you'd walk through with your family. Now, I mean, I'll come back to a job situation. I work around people who aren't calibrated. I guess I'm trying to think of the right way to say this. They're not wrong. They're not enemies. They're just not thinking about culture as explicitly as I am.
Yeah.
So it can be very hard to know how to talk about that in a way that doesn't go too far for their sensibilities at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I often will, you know, I have been into my headmaster's office before to say, hey man, you're right on that, but we got to figure out another way to say it. surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
But
you're that guy.
Oh yeah. I'm definitely that guy, but he and I agree that we need to be, this is why it really is kind of coaching. It's never, so far, thank the Lord, it's never been like rebuke. We're both very aware that constantly pulling the Overton window to the right in our regular conversations is what needs to happen.
Yeah.
And so I look for ways to say things about how ridiculous the drag queen who was on whatever local thing popped up was.
Yeah.
You know, there in my town, praise the Lord, a business that hosted a drag queen event got such backlash that that business had to close. So when I'm in faculty meeting, one of the things I will say is we should thank God that that business, name it by name, had to close because it hosted a drag queen event.
Yeah.
Because I want I want, you know, somebody's going to have to come to me and be like, hey, that's too harsh. Or it is going to set the tone for thinking about it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They might not agree with me, but they know that that's where the verbal Overton window is.
Yeah. And this is something that you said in the talk, or it was at least in your notes. And we may have even mentioned it before when you were going through it. But yeah, you did mention it because of you mentioned John Stewart and those guys. This is exactly what they would be doing to us.
Absolutely.
Oh, those crazy fundamentalist Christians. Mm-hmm. Let me show you this documentary called Shiny Happy People about how crazy these people are and the horrible abuses they commit and how awful homeschooling is for people.
Yep. And like they're doing the exact same thing. You don't do those things. Yep.
Yeah. They're doing the exact same thing to you all day, every day, from every media outlet. So, you know, it's not too harsh to every once in a while say, actually, normalcy is good.
No. In fact, I think you should be profitably scheming how to do that.
Yep.
All right. I guess we can just invite listeners to give us any questions they have, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's any other, we talked about family. We didn't talk a whole lot about churches, but I think the way these things are applicable to families and to schools, it's pretty clear how churches can also be a part of this. And, you know, one thing that I think of off the top of my head, just related to churches, and even in solid, you know, based churches, this can be an issue, is that you get so so wrapped up in your own little circle, where maybe at your church there are people who are a little too judgmental against the people who aren't homeschooling, that you start to target that. And in a way, you're almost preaching subversively now to your own people, mm-hmm. because you're signaling that the homeschooling families are a little too extreme. And I think that can be a danger in conservative churches. And I think it comes from a good intent, which is you want to deal with the actual issues that the people in your congregation might be dealing with.
Yeah.
But what it's telling them can often be harmful, because what it's telling them is, well, the homeschoolers are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I use homeschooling as an example, but it could be any number of different issues. And I think that's something to watch out for in churches when you're trying to be, you know, if an institution is going to head left unless it's explicitly right wing, that's a particular way in which it drifts left.
Yeah, that's a great point, for sure.
All right, so institutional bravery. This was a really good talk that Jeff gave, and I hope we've done it justice in this podcast. If any listeners have any questions about any of the things we've talked about, especially the mockery thing, I think is probably where we're going to be hit the hardest, or with the implication that we don't like interracial marriage, which isn't true for either of us. But the theology of mockery, Jeff, you wrote a paper on that, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote and published it on servantsandheralds.com.
Yeah. Maybe put that in the show notes, because I think that would be helpful for people who might not understand exactly what we're talking about there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's pretty controversial, because there is there's a scornful element to it.
Yeah.
But clearly the Lord makes use of it.
Psalm 2. He holds them in derision.
Yeah, I think it's also a handout. It's a handout and a ladder up to say, look, man, you don't have to do this ridiculous stuff. Yeah. Come here. Come with the rest of us who know better.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So when you're not podcasting and making enemies, how can people find you?
merely J. Wright on Twitter, if anybody wants to connect with me.
Yeah, and I am at Bendel Wary on Twitter. You can also follow the Backwoods Belief Twitter account, at Backwoods Belief. We would really appreciate it if you left us a review on iTunes, good or bad, really. We appreciate either way.
I enjoy
the bad ones almost as good as much as the good ones. thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back with you sometime soon.